Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. One of the daily rituals in Zen temples all around the world is good. So in all Zen temples in Asia, as well as now in the West, one of the daily rituals is the chanting of what's known as the Heart Sutra. And we recite the Heart Sutra here once a week on a Saturday morning when we have a full service, a full ritual in the temples and the monasteries in Japan, for example. They chant it three times a day. It's considered to be a very, very important. It is probably the most well-known text of Mahayana Buddhism. Scholars say it is the purest distillation of wisdom. It was created sometime around the year 200 to help one of the very early schools of Buddhism. In the very early days of Buddhism, for the first few hundred years, many, many different schools developed. Almost immediately, it seems. There were like 16 schools of Buddhism in the first few hundred years, all having a slightly different viewpoint of some little piece of doctrine. So the Heart Sutra was intended to help one of these very early schools give up or let go of the idea or the view of no self and no dharma. So the Heart Sutra provides the deepest teaching of Buddhism, the emptiness of self, emptiness, which is not the same thing as no self. It's a little tricky. Emptiness of self and emptiness of all things. Again, emptiness of things is not the non-being of things. Now, for us, for Westerners, this is pretty confusing. The language is very contradictory because part of the chant says form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. When you first come across that, you wonder where you are. What are they talking about? You know, it's pretty difficult for the mind to hold two opposite ideas at the same time. Here you have form, you know, things, people, objects, and emptiness. So what is the meaning of this emptiness? And besides some philosophical discussion about it or thinking about it, what is its role? What role can it play in ordinary life? I mean, the teachings are fairly unuseful if they don't have some they don't help us in our ordinary life. So what does this notion of emptiness mean for us in our life? Now, the teaching of this sutra, the Heart Sutra, is felt to be very vital. It is intended to help people have understanding. Very vital. But it's pretty confusing. The sutra is intended to help us understand the truth and understand the true nature of the things of this world. And this understanding will lead to the relief of suffering and confusion and will lead to us having an authentic life. So this is pretty important teaching. Our founder, as you know, most of you know, was the Zen master Suzuki, who came to the U.S. in the mid-1950s, came to San Francisco, eventually started the San Francisco Zen Center, and was the founder of this place also in the 60s. And in one of his last lectures, during the last year of his life, he gave a talk where he explained the purpose of our practice. He emphasized that our meditation practice, or zazen, means just sitting. Only sitting, just sitting. And he explained that just sitting actualizes emptiness in our life. So that we can appreciate our life beyond the ordinary understanding and concepts of reality. Beyond the ordinary understanding of the things we see in the everyday world and of the life we live. So the point of the sutra, where we say form is emptiness and emptiness is form, is to help us remember the so-called other world, the world beyond the limited experience that is provided to us by our intellect, that there is another world or another dimension, not a separate world, but a different way of seeing things, seeing the emptiness of things, not just the form of things, not just the everyday appearance and the apparent solidity of things and people. Emptiness points to the reality beyond the everyday. And when we can start to appreciate this so-called other world, then we can let go of our preconceived beliefs and the ideas that have been programmed into us by our culture and our family and the way we are raised in this society. We all carry around a certain set of beliefs because we are influenced by our culture and our parents and our schools and our friends, and we have a certain way of seeing things. So Suzuki Roshi explained to us that when we sit in zazen, when it is just sitting, we can get a glimpse or get a sense of the emptiness aspect of the world. And we are better able to accept life and things just as they are. Truly as they are, without bias. And without wishing they were different. But he explained that if we cannot let go, if we cannot appreciate the empty nature of all things, we become very self-oriented and have a tendency to move towards narrow understanding. And our feelings for ourselves, our feeling for things, and our feeling for others become limited when we only see the world as form. When we don't appreciate or see things so understanding the quality of emptiness of everything and of ourselves we can appreciate the nature of things and we develop a respect and a reverence for everything without a feeling of emptiness. We run the risk of having a casual practice and a casual lifestyle, which can lead to inattention, separation, and the lack of intimacy. We all crave intimacy. We all crave connection with each other. And it can slip away from us if we don't see things clearly. Now, in the modern world, you know, we have many recent conveniences and improvement in the standard of living. Standard of living in the Western world is amazing. The things that we have and the things that we can do. Who could have believed it 50 years ago? But even though we have at our fingertips many conveniences and a high standard of living, nonetheless, the degree of anxiety is increasing. And I know you're aware of that. In our own lives and in the lives of people we know and lives of people beyond who we know personally, anxiety is going up, even though it's a fantastic world in terms of our conveniences. And the sense of satisfaction in our life seems to be decreasing. Part of this decrease of, in the sense of satisfaction is because we are becoming more and more dependent on our conveniences. So, just one simple example. When you come into a room, a dark room, if you want some light, you turn on a switch. Simple. Or, if there's a motion detector, something turns on the switch for you. Pretty convenient. We like it. That's nice. Not too many years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you couldn't turn on a switch to get light. You had to light a candle. Or you had to light a lantern removing the glass chimney, striking a match, turning up the wick, slowly putting the chimney back, and then picking up the candle, the lantern, being extremely careful, because it's a little dangerous if you're not careful. Having to light a candle or light a lantern focused our attention on creating light. We were creating the light, and we were paying attention to it. The way it is now, we don't pay much attention to it. We're very casual about bringing the miracle of light into our room. We never think about it. But years ago, before we had those conveniences, we were very focused on the role we play in creating light. Very focused. So, if we aren't mindful of how we turn on the switch, the activity of doing that is kind of a throwaway activity. We're not even aware of it. We don't even sense that we're doing it. But in the old days, in more difficult times, we were involved, had to be involved in creating the light. So it's a matter of being engaged in creating something, or not so much engaged. This is the danger of all the conveniences that are coming our way. We run the risk of not being engaged because the conveniences are relieving us of responsibility for paying attention. There's a story, a very famous Zen story, ancient China, about a layman, not a famous teacher, but layman Pang. And he wrote a poem, and he ended the poem by saying, "My spiritual practice is carrying water and chopping wood." And those activities are the work of survival. If you wanted to heat your home, if you wanted to cook your food, you had to chop wood to make a fire. And if you wanted water to cook or to drink or to bathe, you had to go out and get it from the well and carry it in a bucket. Work of survival. It was necessary work, and it became a very natural activity. I don't think too many people complained that they had to chop wood. They knew they had to do it. It was part of their life. Today, of course, we hardly think about where our water comes from and how convenient it is to turn on a tap. We don't think too much about how our house is heated. The thermostat turns on the heat automatically. We don't even think about it. Hauling water and chopping wood. They were part of the daily routine of being alive. And I feel strongly that when people did it, they felt satisfaction in doing those activities. They were part of life. So, we cannot go back to a world without conveniences. Nobody wants to advocate that. This is the world we live in, and we have these conveniences. But if we want to regain intimacy with our activities and the way we relate to the world and the way we create such things as light and heat and water, we can regain that intimacy with the world through our Zazen practice. This is one of the reasons why this practice is so vital these days, because we are losing touch with the things that used to make us feel very engaged. So, for example, part of our practice should be when we turn on a light switch, we should pay attention to our hand touches the switch, to the click, you know, to the movement of the switch. We should pay attention. And when we turn on the stove to boil some water for tea, pay attention to how we turn it on and how the flame starts up, not just a throwaway activity. And when we pay attention to these ordinary activities, we get a glimpse of the world of emptiness. That's why this practice is so vital. So if you're at home doing something, let's say you're writing something, you're doing something on your computer, or you're reading something, and your friend, or maybe it's your partner or your wife or your husband comes to you and say, "Hey, let's have a coffee." If you think or you say, "Oh, no, never mind, I'm too busy, I want you to leave me alone." That's not our attitude. That means the mind is not ready. It would be better to say, "What a great idea. Let's have a coffee." Knowing that you can go back to your activity later. But here's an opportunity to relate, to be intimate. That is a ready mind. "Well, perfect. Let's have a coffee." And you stop what you're doing and you turn to the other person. This is a ready mind. This is a mind in balance. This is the mind of no attachment, the mind that is always ready for intimacy. When we are always ready for intimacy, we are getting a glimpse of the world of emptiness. So in our practice, we are taught, don't seek for anything. When you sit in meditation, don't hope to gain something personal, stress relief or something like that. Don't seek for anything, because this activity of seeking, this motivation for seeking something, always includes the idea of a self. I am seeking. And when the idea of a self is involved, our practice cannot come to balance. The striving by the self throws us off balance. In that case, we could not return to emptiness. So when we practice, when we sit in Zazen, we simply try to let go of habits, of those habitual habits of seeking and wanting and desiring. Just sitting, let them go. Return to emptiness. So if when we first hear the sutra of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, say, "Oh, let me try to understand that." And we start thinking about emptiness. Let me see. We soon discover that we cannot reach the truth of emptiness with our thinking mind. It's very frustrating. We can't get there with the thinking mind. So to empty everything, we have to carry around no idea of anything. Or you might say, we have to go back to where no idea of anything arises. Suzuki Roshi, our teacher, gave an example of a glimpse of emptiness in one of his talks to his students. He gave an example of a sense of emptiness. He spoke about how he liked to create miniature gardens, miniature Zen gardens, with small stones and small plants and small trees. And he was seemed to be endlessly creating a small garden around his cabin down at the Tassajara Monastery. But he said one day he went down to the creek to collect some more stones. He saw the rocks and the water in their natural place, and he felt, I can't do this anymore. And then he had a very good friend come to visit him at Tassajara, a master gardener. Suzuki Roshi invited him to help him with his garden, to go down and pick up some stones, and his friend, the gardener, says, I can never work on that rock garden. It would be better to simply clean up Tassajara Creek by taking out the papers and taking out the cigarette butts. Let's take care of Tassajara Creek and not worry about creating a garden, a miniature garden. And Suzuki Roshi said in his talk, a beautiful miniature Japanese garden copies nature. But in nature, there is beauty beyond beauty. So one of the problems that we have as a human being is that we analyze our experiences. We are so much into analyzing and studying and explaining everything we do and everything we see and everything we feel. We analyze our life, we analyze our experiences. What we see, what we hear, what we feel in the world and in our life. And when we analyze something, we are really trying to measure it in some way. Is it big or small? Is it fast or slow? Is it hot or cold? What's its color? So we develop the habit of measuring the things of our life, of measuring the things of our life. We try to understand the things of our life through measurements. This is a modern habit. This is a result of our advancement of science, which has brought tremendous benefits, but you know, it can creep into places where it doesn't belong. It's a modern habit. But the experiences of our life have no dimensions. It's impossible to measure our experiences and our feelings and our intimacy and our love. We can't measure those things. If we try to measure them, we are adding something to them in order to give us a picture for the thinking mind to hold on to. But this picture is not real. It's made up. So a picture of our experience is not intimate. So our practice is to see things with a much wider mind, beyond pictures, and to see that all things of the everyday world are empty. So our practice, our sincere Zazen practice, and the attitude that motivates us, our practice will actualize the emptiness in our life. Not that life is empty, but the true nature of our life, which can't be measured. Our practice enables us to see things as they are, fundamentally and originally, before we add something. So Suzuki Roshi and his gardener friend went down to Tassajara Creek to look for stones, and they said, leave them here. If they would have said, oh, let's take this stone back and put it in our garden, it would be so beautiful there. They're adding something. So they said, leave it. Better we spend our time picking up the trash. So our practice enables us to see things as they are before something is added and before we spoil the reality. So when you sit in Zazen, don't let your mind be disturbed by any sound that comes up or some light that comes up. Don't engage your thinking mind. Let it rest. Don't rely on your thinking mind or your sense organs to tell you who you are. There is another dimension. Just experience reality without measuring. This is our practice, and this is the door to emptiness. So, does anybody have a question? Do you have a question tonight about anything?
My question is, do you think that there's a way to see the emptiness in answering emails?
Sorry?
Emails? Are you familiar with emails? Like sending an
email?
Email, yeah. My question is, do you think, can you see, is there a way of emailing where you could see emptiness in the act of emailing or in email as a thing? Does that question make sense? What I'm getting at is I think that I was thinking about convenience and I was thinking about convenience in the workplace and how that. So my dad's a carpenter, and he just builds stuff every day, right? And he doesn't send emails, he doesn't read them, none of that. And I was thinking about what our jobs are like now. Working in Silicon Valley and technology and stuff like that, and there's something about the convenience of sending an email, I think, that is like is core to the distraction and the lack of what you just described in your talk. And I think there's other things that you can do working here that isn't like that, but emailing seems like the central thing that is distracting and convenient, and so I'm wondering if there's a way to send and receive emails while seeing, the beauty in them, I guess. Or
emails are a way of life.
Sure.
There's no going back. Emails can be like the lights that come on automatically without our effort, and we forget what's going on. So there's two things about being in the world of email. One is when you compose an email, carefully, thoughtfully, mindfully, completely. And the other is, whenever you can meet with somebody in person, when you don't really need to send an email, when you can see somebody in person, take advantage of that. Email is wonderful because if you're doing business with somebody in Sri Lanka or something, that's the only way you can do it. But if your fellow worker is just around the corner, or your partner is at home, the other end of the house, go see them in person. Make an effort to be as intimate as you can whenever you can. And that way, email won't destroy us. It can destroy us. And you know, we feel overwhelmed by it and we're a slave to it, but we don't have to be. We could say, I'm going to remain intimate. I'm going to engage with people whenever I can. That's my motivation. If you have that attitude, then the emails won't be harmful. So that's why our practice can help us not become slaves to the conveniences of technology. That's why I believe more and more people are beginning to sense that they need to do something, because things like email are making people feel less connected. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty important question. I think the answer is go for intimacy whenever you can. Thank you.
Okay, going back to his email thing, many emails are not written by humans anymore. They're written by algorithms and bots, and they're composed and sent out as a proxy for you, right? So, in fact, machines are having relationships with with people. People are not having relationships with people. And that continues. So an email is avatar or bot or something that does something for you. Do you have a comment on that? I mean, how do we actually have relationships with people? Because technology is not going to help with that.
If you get an email that's not composed by a person?
Correct.
There can be no intimacy.
Right.
Delete. Yeah. Have nothing to do with it.
I mean, it comes down to the signaling is not done by you at all. It's done by a algorithm that says, you don't have any milk in the fridge, bring home some milk or whatever it might be.
I think many people like that. Many people like to be reminded automatically, so convenient. But it makes them very casual about how they take care of their life. So, my wife and I say to each other, let's go for a walk, but let's look in there and see, is there anything we need? Take out a pencil and paper and make a list. Don't let any software tell you what you should be paying attention to. So, that's a really good question. The technology is trying to really insinuate itself in our lives. How do we not get carried away? This is a big question these days. If we know how we want to live and how we want to relate to the world, we keep that in mind and not let those avatars, I think you said, not let the avatars run our lives. Thank you.
Well, just to continue this theme about the email, at risk of sounding like an old fogey, I was actually one of the people who worked on email way back in the day when we were first really getting it out into the world. And I guess we were very naive, but we didn't really anticipate all of the downsides of email. All we saw was the convenience. And when we started seeing people suddenly erupting in hostile flame wars and all of these other bad side effects, never mind about conversing with bots, droids over the internet, just talking among people, we were kind of horrified and trying to understand what was going on. And it really became clear that the lack of intimacy, the lack of face-to-face communication, seeing facial expressions and body language and tone of voice, the lack of really communicating directly with a person, and you can't take that kind of communication and turn it into text without taking a huge amount of the meaning out of it and just throwing it on the floor. And looking back on it, I think it's one of the many reasons why those of us who worked on email and other internet things way back then, I wouldn't say we should feel guilty about the fact that we didn't anticipate all of this, but we definitely didn't anticipate a lot of these downsides. And it's kind of sobering to see now the way that you have to almost cut yourself off from a lot of this stuff in order to reestablish the kind of intimacy that you're talking about.
Well, there was no way to anticipate everything. We're very complex creatures, and there's no predicting everything we can do. But when we become aware that there is a problem with this convenient thing that we're using, when we become aware of it, we have to step back and say, how do I respond to that? How do I maintain my integrity in the face of this seduction that this convenience is trying to do to me? How do I remain resolute? How do I maintain my character? I think people are beginning to ask that question these days. It's not your fault. Yeah. Well, I'll send you an email about it, and I'll let you know how. Good, thank you. Yes, Columbine.
This is kind of more of a comment too. As an introvert, I love emails, you know, because when you have to talk to somebody, it's like there's a lot of information that's a distraction from what you're talking about, because there's like, well, does this person like me? You know, are they blaming me for things? So in a way, email just kind of straight to the point. You can send documents. So, and as I've worked, I've noticed that I tend to be very compulsive with emails. For example, I get very like, as soon as somebody sends me an email, I feel like in my gut that until I respond, like this anxious, like they're not gonna know I read their email. It's a weird reaction. And I've noticed that I guess it reminds me of one of my pet peeves is sort of when you have a conversation with somebody. One of my coworkers had like a Fitbit or whatever, and I literally could not have one conversation with her where her Fitbit didn't say, oh, somebody's texting, or she had a water thing that would tell her to take a drink of water. And it was impossible. Like, there was never one conversation where her Fitbit didn't warn her to drink water or something. And that, for me, I think I'm kind of weird.
No.
Like, I'm different from, well, like, I don't take my phone places. Like, I'll just, like, leave it places. And people think that's bizarre. But I find it strange that people place more importance on somebody calling you than like a conversation that is currently taking place. Mm. I don't understand it. Like, they somehow get priority, like, because they dial, like, I don't understand it.
You're not weird. No. The weird thing is being attached to the device rather than giving attention to another human being. That's weird. Well, weird maybe is a little too strong, but that's not helpful. I think your story is a good example about how all of us are coming up against technology and its impact on us, and its negative impact on us, and how do we respond to it? It's a big question that doesn't have any answer yet. So when you get an email, rather than feel anxious about having to return it right away, you say, I'm going to be courteous and return it as soon as I can, because I know they'd appreciate that. That's much different than...
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more. Good.
One of the things I found is when I struggle with my own life in terms of intimacy is that whenever I feel that I'm not, whenever I don't have the courage to be vulnerable, then I find it very hard to be intimate. Intimate in terms of showing, I find myself immediately protecting my persona, or whatever that point of view is. And it comes up in strange ways. It comes up even when I think I'm actually not protecting my persona. Is there any solution for that?
Oh. Continue your practice of just sitting. And little bit by little bit, you'll come to understand that who or what you think you are is not who or what you really are. When we get a glimpse of our true nature, then we're not troubled by such things. Then there is no persona to worry about. This is the point of our practice, to see the empty nature of all the things of the world that we think are so important, especially our personality. As long as we keep sitting little bit by little bit, that misunderstanding dissolves. This is our practice. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.